The comment I was going to make was at the last meeting, I talked about interstellar scattering. And I'll just remind you, for those who are not radio aficionados, interstellar scattering is sort of the radio equivalent of optical scintillation that the optical and infrared astronomers have to face from the atmosphere, but this occurs in the interstellar medium. And in that picture, in the 98 meeting, I argued that there was a region of hyperstrong scattering that was sort of stretching somewhere from up here to somewhere down here, and I'm sort of vague about it. And I actually related it to the X-ray observations. I said I thought that the interstellar scattering was arising at an interface from the X-ray, the diffuse X-ray gas, and the molecular clouds. And so if that picture is right, and I think this is something that will be interesting to explore, combining the X-ray data with some of the existing compact radio sources that have been detected in many of the radio surveys that we've heard about, what we should end up seeing is the hyperstrong scattering region should actually focus our attention right in this region, that there's a lot of the X-ray emission is coming from there, and as a result, there should be a lot of very interesting interaction phenomena between the X-ray gas and the molecular gas in that area. So I think one of the things that we should be thinking about, those of us in the radio should be thinking about, how do our surveys mesh with the X-ray gas, and is my picture of the interstellar scattering in the galactic center correct?
Anyone like to respond? Ramesh.
I'm asking a question as a theorist. At 4 meters wavelength, if you've got really strong scattering like one sees in the galactic plane, you probably won't see the point source at all, right?
You won't see, but in the picture that I presented in Tucson, even at 20 centimeters, you shouldn't be seeing into the galactic center. And so it does raise the question, you know, all these sources that are being picked up at 20 centimeters and even at 90 centimeters,
right,
are they background sources? And if so, then does that tell us something about what the scattering is doing in the galactic center? And then in turn, is that, as I argued in Tucson, really the case that it's related to the X-ray emission?
Right, but is that actually an exclusion zone where you're just missing point sources in the center? That's my question too.
Right. Is there one?
Well, it certainly appeared to me in 98, and I think that's something that should come out of things like Cornelia and Mike Moore's service.
It seems to me, and it's very important to do the source statistics very carefully in terms of certain centers of symmetry there. Because, I mean, as we know, the source that you worked on, it was so surprising, it should have been scattered to many tens of arc seconds, and in fact, it was...
Yeah, that was, it's actually labeled up there as background.
Yeah, the background.
We had a paper in 99 and sort of said, okay, well, there's a gap in the scattering screen. And, okay, well, maybe that's plausible, but you sort of have to worry, well, once there's one gap, maybe there are lots of them. And on the other hand, I think that picture is nicely consistent if the scattering region is concentrated between Sag A and Sag B, where the X-ray emission seems to be, then that background galaxy sort of sits right on the side of it. And so, well, you see some, but you don't see a lot. It's also, I think the source, one of the sources that you use for the Sag A star astrometry sits just to the north of Sag B, and so again, it would sit outside this interaction.
It's in that dark hole up there in the 90s.
To the right of Sag B.
Right.
Yeah.
It's 0.7 degrees north.
Jen Wade?
Yes, there's a question to the theory.
Stand up.
The scattering image always is perpendicular to the galactic plane, and it's something to do with behavior.
No. I think the OHIR stars, the orientations are all over the place.
All over the place. It's not perpendicular.
No.
So it's not related to the larger scale of the behavior.
And you wouldn't expect it to be, because the scattering is arising on subparsec scale, sort of 10 to the 11 centimeter size. So it's not. You would expect no correlation with the large scale
of the behavior.
But it would be related. As Miller said, it's a large scale. You might expect to see large scale features in the sense of where there is scattering.
I mean, it seems to me, this shows yet again the extreme importance of low frequency, high resolution imaging in the radio. And we'll be hearing at this conference from Subhashish Roy, Cornelia mentioned some of Shabash's results. He has a couple of posters and be giving an image. And Shabash's, would you like to give a several minute summary of what frequencies and angular resolutions and what you've been doing? You're going to have to speak up because I'm going to.
The point is.
Much louder. Maybe I'll give you this. Okay.
See, at 16 megahertz, I found that it will be interesting to actually compare what we see at 16 megahertz and say at 5 gigahertz and at 1.4 gigahertz. Because one of the interesting points which I have seen is that using the free absorption, we find that we do see Sagittarius A West partially absorbed at 16 megahertz, whereas as far as the flux estimate of Sagittarius A star goes, we don't see means the flux at 1.4 gigahertz and at 16 megahertz is very close to each other. So what already it is indicating is that probably the Sagittarius A star is in front of Sagittarius A West. So that is already one thing we find interesting. And so that is one part. And the other part will be that what I find at 74 megahertz, it will be interesting to find the electron density in the galactic center region over the whole region, because the free absorption may give us a handle on it. Because if we can do that, I would like to go to the north result of see the many of the non-thermal filaments and the relation of the magnetic field there.
Yes. I mean, I think it is to bring you in at the GMRT, which is a low frequency instrument running that's run by the Tata Institute in India in Kodad in northeast of Bombay. The frequencies available are 20 centimeters, 610, 327, 235, is it, and around
160?
Well, yeah, but it will. I mean, surely. But the 235 image is certainly pretty routine now. Some of us have done that successfully. And the angular resolutions of some seconds of arc or some tens of seconds of arc, so it really is a very good, valuable new facility. Daniel.
I just want to make a comment on a possible, very interesting project for the radio astronomers. Difficulties we have facing is X-ray astronomy to determine the total column density on the line of sight that is needed to be used to, for example, to estimate how many background X-ray sources might be contributing in the field. But we don't have a good tracer, really, to estimate such a total column density. So one nice way to do that is to find the X-ray counterparts in radio, or possibly the only way to do it, based on the morphology of extragalactic morphology, the radio galaxies, things like that. If we can find such a counterpart, then we can measure the X-ray column density. Then we can compare with existing tracers like dust emission, H1, absorption and CO emissions, and we can calibrate what might be the ratio between X-ray absorption and these tracers. And we can use the mapping or dust mapping and the CO mapping then to estimate the total amount of X-ray absorption possibly to any directions. It's very, very important, but so far we still lack any, for example, any such counterpart in that sense.
I mean, one possibility that's pretty obvious is to take the new list of hundreds of new sources that Mike Moore and others are finding and do a very deep H1 absorption. So we can at least measure the 21 centimeter opacity.
We really need to find extragalactic ones.
Well, those sources must be extragalactic,
yeah,
in general, aren't they?
Most of
those sources are going to be extragalactic, so we're just sampling the whole pile through the whole galaxy.
But you only find a couple, two or three counterparts of the comparisons, but you are never sure two or three sources are actually, they are extragalactic sources or not.
Yes.
You'll be happy to know that this afternoon I'll be presenting a talk with a map of estimated column density in the
center part of the galaxy based on an LVG analysis using carbon monoxide 7 to 6 and carbon monoxide 4 to 3 transitions.
Right. But that's like you try to figure out the elephant based on the tooth, like the teeth, right? Just based on carbon monoxide, so you still don't know the metallicity and basically the X factor to make the translation. It's very difficult. I see, especially towards the center of the galaxy, things could be abnormal. So you need a calibration. And the best way to do that is X-ray measurement of column density is very reliable. But then you need to find basically some kind of sources. You know the location, which is outside our galaxy. Then you can start comparing with all these traces to the calibration. But first thing is the mapping will be good, but then you need to do the calibration to make it sure that it's the converging.
Something else came up during the coffee break. I was had a discussion with Mark Morris and some others. And Mark, you want to summarize some of your possible controversial heresies about the the Omega arc?
Crystal Brogan does the service of reminding us all that there's this galactic center lobe that Sofui and collaborators had proposed in the 80s was a result of energy released from the galactic center of magnitude equivalent to 1,000 supernovae or more. But this idea lost favor at some point because the one side, the western side of the galactic center lobe, now this is something on a scale of 1 degree or 150 parsecs, so we're talking about an enormous structure. And the western side of the structure, it has a thermal character. It has dust emission, it's one of the brightest 25 micron sources in the galaxy, as seen by IRAS and MSX. It has molecular gas and a nice vertical wall climbing up this western lobe with a fairly substantial amount of neutral molecular gas. And so if Yoshida and collaborators pointed out in the early 90s, this is Kevin Yoshida, that that differs dramatically from the non-thermal western side of this lobe. The eastern side of the globe, which is the extension of the galactic center radio arc, and that just looks like a radio emission. So the continuity of this lobe that was so striking in Crystal's images is a puzzle, because on one side you have the completely thermal, and the other side completely non-thermal structures, and they seem to meet at the top above the galactic center. Is this a bubble that's been blown by some energy release? The fact is, it's a little bit off center. The thermal part on the west is a full half degree away from the center, whereas the non-thermal part is 0.2 degree away from the center. So it's a kind of a skewed bubble, if it's a bubble at all. So I think the reality of this thing is in question, but we do have to worry about whether the same structure could. An energy release could lead to really dramatically different manifestations on the two sides of the center.
I just have curiosity. If it's got thermal and non-thermal, is there anything corresponding in the X-ray? I mean, we've seen all these new X-ray results. Is there anything corresponding in the X-ray to this flow? I mean, wouldn't we expect it?
It'd be good to hear from the people who've done the large-scale survey.
Daniel? I look at the Rosetta All Skies, not All Skies survey, actually we did a mosaic of the Rosetta pointings, which covers very large regions, about 3 or 4 degrees regions. And we did see some feature, diffuse X-ray features corresponding to the top of this lobe. And certainly other the east side, we see a huge amount of absorption, which might explain, actually says, if my recollection is correct, there's also a middle infrared source towards that, in that direction, which might explain the possible thermal effect and
on the west side.
Yeah. So yes, the bottom line is there are features in the X-ray and possibly, I published actually in the conference proceeding, but we certainly should compare the simulation in radio analytics for just so my head.
A question I would have of anybody who wants to say that there was an energy release at the nucleus is, where's the other side? This is all to the northern side of the galaxy, and there's no known comparable lobe on the southern side, although the galactic center arc continues to the south. There's no complete lobe down there.
So on the other side, also, we see actually even stronger X-ray emission, and which is not loop, not a morphology, not a, like jet. No, it's not really a jet. It's a kind of outflow in the way beyond the, our Chandra Surya field, which extends like degrees away from the plane. And now it's an even larger scale, it's about tens of degrees. We see actually typical hollow cone-shaped X-ray features, which are typically seen in the starburst galaxies. And now, it's you have to put all things on different scales all together. It's difficult, problem, but you know, it's possible.
I just wanted to make
Crystal first, and then
I just wanted to make the quick comment that we would not be able to see anything on the southern lobe because of that large region of diffuse H2
yeah.
regions to the northeast of Sag A that are local and absorb all of the emission at 74 megahertz anyway. So we wouldn't be able to detect the southern.
Yeah. Okay, Chris.
Something that's going to come up later in the session is the issue of metallicity in the stars in the galactic center and in the H2 regions. And one of the real puzzles for us when Solange Maris in her PhD thesis found that the stars in the galactic center had solar iron abundances was very surprising to us. Is there's all these generations of star formation going on. What happens to the enriched gas? Which comes back, in my mind, to the question of, is there enough of these outflows from the X-rays, you know, where you have 50 supernovas go off or whatever. Is that dragging all the enriched gas out of the galactic center so we don't ever get a pileup of nucleosynthetic process gas in the galactic center, or is that X-ray gas confined and it comes back into the galactic center, and then why don't we see that in the abundance pattern? So it seems to me to be that the issue of whether or not the X-ray gas that's detected is confined gravitationally or not, whether we have a stellar fountain, a stellar wind, or just stellar or X-ray bubbles that are completely confined is crucial to understanding the chemical enrichment cycle in the galactic center.
Good point. You want to respond to that and pull the cover off?
I never happened to attach a few images to my talk. This is a much, much larger scale. From Rosetta All Sky Survey in the highest end possible. So extinction is the least important. Gas filter is right here. And so I also have a mosaic covers the central region to show much details, but this is All Sky Survey. But you can see this canonical kind of hollow cone shaped features, which really indicates a kind of outflow of hot gas from central region, which is, nobody really paid attention to this kind of features. I happen to look at it for a proposal, so I think it's useful, but you needed to combine all the information in the radio and possibly also not only the continuum, also the line machines to put together to find a coherent picture. But it needs a lot of work. This is one of the I'm not sure if this
others. I think do I get the point correct? I mean, Chris is making one should look very carefully at the abundance.
Well,
gradients and absolute values in the diffuse gas and compare with the stellar.
There's two things. One is looking at the abundance gradients, and two is looking at the inflow and outflow mechanisms to the galactic center. I mean, in Mark's paper, Mark Dean Saragin wrote about continuous star formation in galactic center, stuff falling in, forming new stars, and then question is what happens to the gas that forms, with those little stars lose their mass as AGB stars and they blow up a supernova, that gas is now, enriched in elements. Where does it go? Does it stay in the galactic center or does it escape? And understanding, how much gravitational confinement is there compared to how much X-ray pressure for the X-ray gas to escape is there? Has anyone done that calculation?
We are all aware of the question. It's a fundamental question we try to address, not only for our galaxy, also for nearby galaxies and also in cosmology. So actually one of our research fields is to try to understand the outflows from galaxies. But it's a very difficult problem, especially in terms of the measurements of the metallicities, which you are depending on the understanding of the dynamics of the outflows. And also the fundamental question is whether the gas is in the ionization equilibrium situation or not. And basically, so far that could not be used to test such models. You normally do is assume kind of model, then try to measure the contents, the metallicity system. It's not very reliable. And there are some arguments saying, yes, you do see the metal-enriched hot gas flowing out from centers of galaxies, but the concluding is not very conclusive.
We are running out of time. May I ask a question myself of some of the X-ray? It's probably directed to you, Daniel. You made this, to me, extremely important statement that I'm sure many of you are aware of. The 80% of the emission is from the diffuse emission. But my question is, how solid is the evidence that this could be due to a thermal hot gas? And if so, what is the origin? What are the heating mechanisms for the 10 to the 7 Kelvin?
I think this is really straightforward, because the argument for the thermal origin is you see the lines.
Yes.
Okay, so it's very, very clear. Right. Compared to the typical point-like sources, they normally continue to dominate. In terms of what's the next one?
What's the source of the heating?
There's enough energy from supernova. So there's no energy problem. So really the problem actually is how you load the mass into the hot gas. And then you can just pump the energy in and then you heat the gas to infinite temperature almost, and then you escape. Then you won't get much mass involved in the hot gas. So really is to do how you to heat the gas efficiently in terms of mass. That's the hard part. But you have it's theoretically it's a very difficult problem.
Confinement problem.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. There are lots of additional questions, but I've been told we're running out of time. I suggest we continue this discussion over lunch.